Megan, Anna, and I are so excited to have a repeat sponsor who's supporting the Divergent Conversations podcast. Landmark College is the world's first accredited college designed exclusively for students who learn differently. Landmark, located in Putney, Vermont, which is one of my favorite states, offers courses in person and online, awarding associate and bachelor's degrees, and offering pre-college, gap year, and professional development programs for educators who work with neurodivergent students. With a student-to-faculty ratio of just 7-1, and the renowned Landmark College Institute for Research and Training, Landmark offers personalized and research-informed support for neurodivergent students that is not available at traditional colleges. Still enrolling for fall 2025. Learn more about this opportunity at landmark.edu. That's landmark.edu. Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Divergent Conversations, and this is our last episode in the Autistic Burnout series or season, and I am so excited that we are wrapping it up with Dr. Mel Hauser. Dr. Mel Hauser, in case you don't know them, has been on our podcast twice before. They are an autistic physician, founder of All Brains Belong. They do such a good job talking about all the things, and the reason I'm really excited that we're having you on to wrap up this series is the more I talk about autistic burnout and get questions about it, I have started to get a bit anxious of, oh no, are we doing a lot of diagnostic overshadowing of calling something autistic burnout when actually there's underlying health conditions? And then because we have the name burnout, we're not looking at those health conditions. So I think you're going to help us unpack some of that today. And I'm just really excited to have you back on. Thanks for making the time.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree. I think that, you know, autistic burnout is often framed purely as like an emotional or psychological or, you know, anyway, but for many of us, it's also physiological, because when you have, particularly if you have certain medical conditions that impair energy production and energy regulation, like long COVID, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, dysautonomia, like all mast cell dysfunction, there's all these conditions that are connected with mitochondrial dysfunction. And so like even small daily demands, you know, processing the light from the window, let alone like the fluorescent light, you know, social navigation, you know, maintaining your body being upright, like all that stuff can be pushing you into a state of energy depletion. And we can talk more about that.
I want to like parse out like every like phrase of what you just said, but can we start with mitochondrial dysfunction, because I think this one is so interesting, but also probably not understood by a lot of our listeners, or if there's a different starting point.
Yeah, maybe I can, just because in case there's listeners who missed especially the first time I was on, maybe just talking about autistic and ADHD people are more likely to suffer from a constellation of intertwined medical problems that involve the nervous system, the immune system, both of which run through the whole body. And so this ends up impacting multiple organ systems. So, you know, people may present with digestive symptoms, maybe connective tissue, including musculoskeletal and blood vessel problems. There's a huge, huge list, and maybe we can link in the show notes to that earlier episode, but things like mast cell activation syndrome, hypermobility spectrum disorder, or hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, you know, a range of sleep disorders like obstructive sleep apnea and others, migraine, endometriosis, I mentioned before, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, you know, a range of post-infectious chronic illness like long COVID, like chronic Lyme. The list goes on and on and on. So it's the idea of like first matching that pattern. And you should assume that if you have that cluster, that constellation of intertwined medical problems, you likely have a higher likelihood to have problems with your mitochondria. So like if we can think back to like whatever grade, biochemistry, biology, mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell, it makes energy and is responsible for regulating how we spend our energy. So like basic things, rolling over in bed, the complexities of standing up, the complex motor skill of spoken communication, let alone like everything we're doing. I mean, everything costs energy, and we don't always think about this seeming everyday life stuff that costs energy. I mean, everything costs energy. So when you have mitochondrial dysfunction or problems with your mitochondria, you maybe don't make enough energy and you don't spend it like other people spend it. You don't spend it efficiently.
That tracks. So that feels like the scientific explanation of something that I often say, which is autistic people just need a lot of rest. We just do. And it's obnoxious, but it's just a reality. And I think you're uncovering some of the like scientific underpinnings of why that is, that there's actually cellular reasons.
Right. And so like we try to support people in unlearning that, you know, productivity focused capitalist notion of like push through, suck it up, do more. This is at a cellular level. This is not a lack of willpower or laziness or whatever. This is like at a cellular level. Your mitochondria don't make enough energy. So what are you going to do?
That's the $1 million question, right? Is like, what are you going to do? Because as you're sitting here listing symptom after symptom or struggle after struggle, I'm like checking the mental box in my head of like, yep. And because we live in that capitalist society, and because we don't have a lot of medical providers like yourself that are accessible and understanding, what is the answer to that question?
Yeah, I think, and certainly we can talk about some of the supports for mitochondrial function. Like we can definitely do that today. But like one more concept I want to introduce for folks is the idea of post-exertional malaise. So we talked about this the second time I was on your podcast. But what post-exertional malaise or PEM is, it is a worsening of symptoms following even minor activity. And so that what that can look like, you know, someone says that they have more pain or soreness or aching or a flu-like feeling or brain fog, or some people use the word crash. Sometimes this can be right after activity. Sometimes this can be a delayed onset, which makes it really hard. So maybe we don't start to have the onset of PEM until like 12 or even 48 hours after activity. It's not just going to last for days. What PEM, we don't exactly know what causes PEM, but it's thought to be a combination of mitochondrial dysfunction plus dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, that is dysautonomia. I remember when I was on last time, there was like a whole bunch of feedback from social media around like, you know, are you saying all autistic people have PEM? Like, no, we were never saying that. And if you have a complex chronic illness like ME/CFS, long COVID, you may very well have PEM. And if you don't know what that is and no one's talked with you about that, you may not get better because you're always in PEM. Right. You will get better if you stay out of PEM. And so if you don't know what it is, how will you stay out of it?
The beauty of people commenting on 30-second clips of a 60-minute conversation.
So this was so interesting the first time I learned about PEM, because I was trying to find language to describe this experience. And so the language I've used is sensory sick, and how at the end of like a work day, especially when I used to work in the hospitals, I would get flu-like, I would just feel sick. And I was like, I think I'm sensory sick, but it's because I didn't have language for PEM of like, this is the body crashing. Because I was really confused. Why am I getting these fevers? Why am I? But it's that is exactly, or even now, if I'm in Zoom interviews for more than 2 hours, typically, like I start feeling feverish. Yep.
And I've experienced a lot of that too. And I used to describe it without having the language of being like, I'm having this like malaise-esque feeling come over me. I'm taking my temperature. I don't have a fever, But I feel like internally, like I have the flu, I have some sort of virus, everything is shutting down. And medical professionals would be like, your vitals are fine.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we hear that all the time. You know, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome is not something that I learned about in medical school. Most healthcare professionals, this is not a pattern. I mean, a lot of us, we fill our brains with patterns and we match the patterns when we see patients. But if you like didn't get taught about a thing, you can't match the pattern when you see it. This unfortunately is one of the many reasons that patients go without this, you know, lens or this narrative of understanding what's happening. But like you both knew what it was.
Well, and so since learning about PEM, one of the things I've started getting better at, because I'm very much one of the ways I've adapted, you know, I do a lot of talking around the level of like identity and core schemas. One of the ways I have adapted to kind of neurodivergent shame is through hyperindependence, workaholism, overworking. So I used to push through PEM. I'd maybe be like, okay, let me find a lower cognitive task to do, but I would just keep pushing through. And once I learned about it, I started honoring like, okay, I'm starting to get feverish. I'm going to go like lay under a weighted blanket for a little bit. And I stopped trying to push through it. Is that the kind of thing that like you do with your patients and what you recommend is like pacing? And yeah. And because I talk about pacing systems a lot, but I'm guessing that that would be part of the response to PEM is to pace and to start learning your signals.
Absolutely. So I think that, you know, just what pacing means is it means modulating your activity. So anything that uses energy we'll call activity. That can be physical. Even sitting upright is a physical activity. But cognitive activity, being on the computer, reading, thinking, emotional activity, you know, like having an argument with someone, even like having a happy experience with someone. So all that and being up against gravity, that is, you know, activity. So it's like sort of recognizing, oh yeah, what I didn't really think of counts as an activity actually is, and I have to modulate that. So what modulation of activity or pacing or energy conservation is. And there's all kinds of protocols we can link to evidence-based protocols for pacing. But the whole idea is you figure out what your baseline is, like what you can sustain, which is usually half of what you think you can manage. That's your baseline. And then you have these like thresholds for stopping what you're doing. So you know, what most of us have been grown up internalizing this narrative, it's like you fight it, you push through it, you know, you'll feel better when it's done. Like, nope, not when it's post-exertional malaise. We're talking about cellular no energy. So it's pushing through, sucking it up. Oh, I'll feel better. I can rest when I'm done. Like that doesn't work here. And what we know is that pushing through post-exertional malaise prolongs recovery. It makes people sicker. It hurts the mitochondria. So it's like, yes, there's capitalism. And then there's like biology where you don't make the energy in your cells. So anyway, I found that when I met ME/CFS criteria and I learned that I was experiencing PEM, which I didn't know, I have long COVID, but I had ME/CFS from a head injury before COVID. So I had no idea, like ME/CFS, I kind of knew that it was a thing, but I didn't know that you could get it triggered by any number of assaults to your neuroimmune system, including head injuries, surgeries, pregnancy, you know, all these kinds of flares, triggers. But this gave me a lens of like, oh, I just have to pace. Okay. And so baseline. So if I, Megan Anna, you said, if I'm on Zoom for more than 2 hours, I get symptoms. So if you don't get symptoms at the 1 hour mark, your baseline is half of that. I'm going to limit all my Zooms to 30 minutes. And you might find that even after a few days of doing that, your capacity increases. So it's by like doing the radical. And again, like it's so much privilege. It's so much privilege. Like here I am. I have the flexibility of working from home. I'm working from bed. I'm literally flat right now because I'm not using energy. If I'm talking and I'm not in bed all day, but when I'm talking, or I'm on the computer, I am flat because I'm using my energy to talk and think and computer. I'm not spending energy being upright. I can't combine them. My brain fog gets too bad. So anyway, that like, so you're also doing those trade-offs.
Can I just ask like logistics? Because yeah. Minus when I'm in a meeting, I am on a couch where my legs are flat because otherwise like my feet will be swollen after this meeting just from sitting for this long. What is your technological structure that you're able to be flat and do computer work? Because that sounds amazing. I think that would be so helpful for me. Like, where is your computer right now?
Yeah. Okay. I'll see if I can figure out how to take a picture so we can have in the show notes or something as a diagram. I also have the privilege of in Vermont, we have a vocational rehab program called Higher Ability Vermont. Most states have a vocational rehab program. So with their support, I was able to get a desk that is wider than my bed and is on either side. So it's across my bed right now. And it moves up and down if I have to be in different positions. So, but like desk long enough or wide enough, whatever you want to think about it, like wider than the bed so that I can have it closer or farther away to me. I have a laptop on the desk on an angle. It's like on a textbook. So it's like this. Mm-hmm. And I have like a wrist guard in front of it so it keeps it from falling on me. So it's up on the textbook, stopped by the barrier of the wrist guard. And then I have a second, like a detachable keyboard that's on my lap. And next to me, like in my plane of my body, is a mouse pad and a mouse.
Oh my goodness. I need your setup.
I'll take a picture. But again, like it's such a privilege that I have the kind of job that I can do in this position, whereas like so many people don't have that privilege and don't have agency. Like when, you know, I didn't have to work from bed when I first had my current job, but like most people can't, they don't have the agency to make big changes like that, but there might be little changes like figuring out when do I get symptoms, which is very hard for a lot of us with interoception differences. Where we don't feel the things until the signals are really big. I think with time and practice, there can be some like, oh yeah, that thing I feel, I could do something, as opposed to like, oh yeah, it hurts. It always hurts. Like there's kind of gradations, but that takes some practice and maybe working with a helping professional around that.
Mm-hmm. I think about how much time like during my life that I spend horizontal instead of vertical. Like I'm laying on my couch or my bed all the time. And I used to feel unbelievably guilty for it of like all day, every day I'm in my bed if I'm not doing something else or whatever. But you're right. It's so privileged to say I have the ability to do that. And I remember working in like crisis units. And even when I was in private practice and client after client, sitting up, standing up, rushing around from environment to environment. And it was just like, it was hellacious. And what I've been able to create now in my life is much more sensory friendly. And I have so much more control over it. But it is such a privileged position for me to be like, I do have control over my environment 99.9% of the time.
Totally. And Patrick, thanks for bringing up the sensory element of this. So processing sensory information is an activity. It takes energy to do. And so while someone may not have the privilege of being able to control their position, they may be able to limit some of the sensory information that comes into their nervous system. So shortly after I had COVID, one of my staff said, hey, I'm noticing that when you have the lights on in your office, you get tired and cranky. Sure enough. So really, since that time, I work in the dark. Sometimes I have to put the lights on. Like if a patient wants light, we put the light on. But I have tinted glasses when that happens. So that we're navigating the conflicting access needs aspect of that. But it's the idea of I do have, maybe if I can't change what position I'm in, I might be able to modulate how much input is coming in. The lights don't bother me in my office, but they are still costing me energy, and I don't make a lot of energy.
We'd like to take a moment to talk about Jane, one of our sponsors who helped make this episode possible. Jane is a practice management software built for every kind of mental health practitioner and is thoughtfully designed with your clients in mind. Jane makes it convenient to meet with individuals, couples, or families, whether that's online, via Jane's telehealth options, or in person.
From day one, you can expect unlimited customer support through onboarding that sets you up for success and a 99.99% software reliability that ensures that Jane is always ready to start the day with you.
Just as you're always learning and improving, Jane is too. The team at Jane values customer feedback and uses it to design even more helpful features. So you can think of Jane as a software that grows with you.
If you're curious to see Jane in action, head to jane.app/mentalhealth/US to book a free one-on-one demo. You can also mention the code DCPOD at signup for a 2-month free grace period on your new Jane account.
Okay, so pacing and then reducing sensory input and making adjustments to reduce the amount of energy output. That's a huge piece of this. What about, because I see like, I used to follow the keto diet, which was all about the mitochondrial. And like, I see this all the time, like these kind of what feel like fad movements that are like, this will strengthen your mitochondria. Are there things that do help support our energy on that cellular level?
Totally. And I'm using my hands to make a pretend list so I don't forget to answer your question. I think I have to first introduce one more concept, or actually two more.
Go for it.
Okay, so one is part of this constellation of intertwined medical problems that most of us have are two things we haven't talked about. One is POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, where the autonomic nervous system is basically not tolerating gravity. And so you may literally not have blood flow to your body parts. So the physiology is that you get up against gravity and your autonomic nervous system is not constricting your blood vessels enough to get the blood back up. And so that's why we have things like pooling. You mentioned swelling, pooling in with gravity. That's why we have brain fog when we're upright. That's why maybe digestion and how quickly digestion happens is impacted. There's all maybe my pupils don't constrict when I'm in bright light, so I'm more sensitive to light. There's all these things that dysautonomia causes that we don't like necessarily think about as an autonomic nervous system problem. Temperature regulation. Somebody mentioned temperature regulation before. That's dysautonomia. Yeah. So that is another reason why we feel so terrible when we're upright. So why that's important is that the autonomic nervous system talks to the immune system. And yet another component of the constellation is mast cell dysfunction or mast cell activation disorder, MCAD, where our mast cells, just part of our immune system, are sounding the alarm in response to either an external threat or an internal threat. And so the autonomic nervous system mast cells are talking to each other in both directions. So if I, as an autistic person, am experiencing something as a threat, and there's a million threats in the environment is inherently threatening. So I'm going to have a big autonomic nervous system response, which I'm going to have a big mast cell response. And both of those things, the autonomic nervous system and the mast cells, talk to the mitochondria. So the best way that you can support your mitochondria is dealing with your mast cells and dealing with your autonomic nervous system, dealing with your POTS / dysautonomia. So you can't skip that part. And that's complicated. And we can link to some free resources. So Auburn's Belong has a free resource called The Everything's Connecting to Everything, Improving the Healthcare of Autistic and ADHD Adults. And we have it's written out evidence-based strategies, including supporting the mitochondria and dealing with your mast cells and your POTS and your EDS and all the things. Anyway, so that's a framework. But then I will actually answer your question, which is there are some specific supplements, for example. By the way, I do need to name the disclaimer. We're halfway through the episode and I haven't given the disclaimer. This is for education purposes only. This is not medical advice. Please talk to your doctor. And if you don't have a doctor that knows about this, the other part of that Everything's Connected to Everything resource is a letter that you can print out, hand to your primary care clinician, let it speak for you, let it, it's written in language that doctors are used to communicating in. You don't have to worry about contorting yourself to like say the right things to get their attention. Just print it out, hand over the letter, and they can read things that were created for them to look at. Some supplements that are described in that guide. There's a lot of other things that people take, but these are the ones that I think have some like good evidence to support them. So one is coenzyme Q10, CoQ10. CoQ10 is a mast cell stabilizer. It is also good for the mitochondria. That's one. I'd say that another really a really impactful thing is carnitine. So you can get carnitine in food like egg yolks and meats and things like that. But carnitine or acetyl L-carnitine is a supplement that is available. Also increases neurotransmitter production. So a lot of people who have dopamine-bound brains, they do really well on acetyl L-carnitine for that reason as well. Those are, I think, like some of the really, really impactful ones. There are others that are described that maybe has some trade-offs, but for all comers, I think those are good starting points. There are nutritional considerations for mitochondria. Actually, this is interesting. By the time this airs, there's another resource that will exist. We just did a collaboration with the folks at Autism Level Up. It's a resource on post-exertional malaise, and it has a page on like supporting your mitochondria through food and supplements and stuff. So that's going to launch this Friday. So that'll be available to link in the show notes when this episode launches. Anyway, so it's really like from a mast cell lens, there may very well be foods that you are eating, things you are consuming that your mast cells are sounding the alarm to. And though, you know, I also want to acknowledge that in our community, we've got high rates of eating disorders, past or present, and we don't want to be like, start cutting out all the things. Like, we don't want to have that because I really think that for a lot of people, whether that be, you know, lifelong sensory related things, maybe somebody has ARFID or maybe somebody has like any number of things that impact their ability to feed themselves. Feeding yourself is hard and like fed is best. And we also want to acknowledge that if the mast cells are sounding the alarm, that is going to be playing a role in how someone is able to recover from their all the things. So I think just there's a lot of internal conflicting access needs where like parts of ourselves need something and parts of ourselves need something else. And it's not just psychological or emotional parts work. It's like your physiology, your nervous system, your immune system, and all your organ systems often have conflicting needs.
I have this reoccurring image while we're having this conversation, unfortunately, with all this information of like being a bubble boy person. Yeah. Of like the only way I can protect myself is if I'm in this like bubble moving through the world because everything is so impactful. And I imagine for a lot of people listening, like it almost creates a level of hopelessness and despair of like, how the hell do I move through this in a way that supports me best? And what I'm hearing is like pacing, small incremental change, doing the things that we can control and acknowledging that there's so much coming at us at all times, biologically, environmentally, sensory, all of the things, right? That it can create a level of cynicism, I think, probably in the medical community too, where they're like, what the fuck do you want me to do here?
But I would also say that I think that medical professionals have a responsibility to keep learning. So for example, and I've had this experience as a patient, and so have many of my patients, where you go to see a doctor and they're like, well, can't you just like move more? Just move more. You'll feel better. That is the opposite advice of what someone with ME/CFS needs. Because what someone with ME/CFS who's having PEM, what they need is to stay out of PEM. And what you'll find is that if you have the privilege of being able to aggressively and radically pace, even for a few days, you can start to see the needle move in capacity. And some people, you know, don't have that privilege. But, you know, even if you have to be caring for children or caring for pets or whatever, like if you can spend all your time when you're not required to do something, you can spend it flat. Like, that would be helpful, but also treating your POTS, making sure that you have enough hydration and you have enough electrolytes, and maybe you need some medicines or supplements to deal with your POTS or your mast cell activation, et cetera. I think it's not hopeless. Like, I think that what we see in our practice is we see people getting better. I'll also say another resource that might be good to link. There's this amazing website. I'm going to say this. I'm not saying that this is the right website to use for everyone, but if someone has capacity to engage with the idea that maybe something that they're eating might be making their mast cells pissed off, there's this website called whatthebleepcanieat.com. And at the bottom of it is a food detective. And if you know that there are things that make your body sound the alarm, you plug them in. And this website is amazing because it may seem like all the food makes you sick, but you may not realize what some of these things have in common. For example, I recently learned that I have salicylate intolerance. Even though I tell people about whatthebleepcanieat.com every day of my life, I'd never actually used it. It jumped off the screen to me that this is what was wrong. And within like really a few days, I had a different life.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm like back to working in my office for the first time in 2.5 years. It's like the mast cells will sound the alarm, and like they may sound the alarm for things that are not actually threats. You know, like maybe dairy's not really a threat, but your mast cells think everything's a threat because something else is pissing them off. Or, you know, maybe gluten, maybe some soy, or like all the things that people, you know, may actually be mast cell threats, or it might just be that mast cells are responding to something else. And if you deal with the something else, maybe now your mast cells can tolerate these other things. Mm. I think there is a lot of reason to be hopeful. I totally get why it feels really demoralizing and discouraging, but I think a lot of times the reason that people suffer for so many years is like you're missing this core part. Like maybe you're missing POTS and you don't know you have that, or you're missing mast cell dysfunction. Maybe you've never even heard of PEM before. So it's like you support each of these pieces with strategies that don't make the other pieces worse.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, when you break it down that way. And I say this every time you're on here, but I really wish you were in North Carolina. Every time I go to my doctor, I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to go listen to Mel's advice instead.
Well, it's too hot down there for my POTS, so maybe you should move up here.
Listen, if my wife was like, I'll move to the Northeast, I would move back home in a heartbeat. So trust me, North Carolina summers are not for me.
Yeah.
That's why I stay in my house. 90%.
That's another piece, right? So coping with your environmental changes, that also uses energy.
Yeah.
So, you know, thinking about how am I gonna navigate the heat or the cold or switching back and forth between them, these are all mast cell triggers. Anyway.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting because something I hear a lot also is like autistic people, and I probably say autistic people struggle with like homeostasis and regulation and temperature regulation. And I think if I'm getting you right, you'd probably say, well, that's actually not autism.
Yes, that dysautonomia.
Is, that's
dysautonomia that is more common in autistic people.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we just like sort of skip it.
Because of like all my Misdiagnosis Monday series, right, I'm always talking about all the things that overshadow autism. But this bit, and this is the bit that I've just come to really appreciate in the last couple of years, autism can become a diagnostic overshadow for so many medical things. And we're like, well, that's just part of the autistic experience. Like Patrick and I talk a lot about grief of like, well, I'm just going to, these are my limits. I'm going to grieve them. And I, like, there is some honoring of like living in a body that has more limited energy. But I also sometimes I wonder if like, am I trying to grieve things that I'm saying are autism that actually are maybe like things like there's so many health words that are hard for dyslexics.
Yeah.
Like dysautonomia.
Yeah. 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 That word. I know what you mean. No, seriously. I agree. And so like the same way that we honor sensory and any number of access needs, we need to honor energy access needs. So it's like pacing, reducing hidden energy, and like designing life around what your body can do without triggering PEM. And while you're doing that, it is normal to grieve. It's so normal to grieve the loss of what you're not able to do. And so a lot of times it's like reimagining, maybe even in the temporary, if I have like a toolbox of what I do to get dopamine, or I have a toolbox for like what brings me joy, or maybe those are the same things, maybe they're not. If I can't do those things, I feel terrible. I feel inertia. I just feel terrible all the time. So I also have to do the work of like making a list of some other things that I can do. And it's not forever. I don't think this is about doing less forever. It's just about creating safety for your brain and your body so you can recover some capacity.
So, and this, you might not have the answer to this, but this I think would be an interesting conversation point, because this is also a psychological question. For a lot of us, whether it's because we've adapted to shame through workaholism, or whether it's because of complex trauma, doing nothing creates a sense of unsafety.
Yes.
And from what I'm hearing is the mast cells react to a sense of threat.
Yes.
But how do you work with people for whom pausing and being still and resting actually creates threat?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's about figuring out like, what does rest look like? And so for some people that might be laying down in the dark, staring at a wall. For some people, it might be like, maybe they can be doing something that's off a screen, but they're working with their hands or they're creating something. For some people, they can read a book and not get PEM. For other people, that's not true. For some people, they could listen to your podcast and maybe not get PEM. Maybe for some people, they get really engaged with it and maybe they're spending a lot of cognitive energy. But it's really just like exploring, like what does it look like to rest without doing nothing? So you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talk about that a lot of like rest often looks different for us, especially for ADHDers, of like, I find classic rest very not restful. And so it's like, I have to be doing something. And it's a lot of things you mentioned, like listening to an audiobook, but being flat, and maybe even having an eye mask on so that it's like dark and I'm sensory deprived, but I'm getting some kind of input that's scratching my productivity itch.
Totally.
Yeah. I think that's such a great question. And distinction, because we talk about the restlessness component of the ADHD parts all the time on this podcast and how doing nothing is not exactly comforting or relaxing. But I think reframing it to like just limiting input and doing things that are low energy experiences would be much more helpful for me, I think, going forward.
Totally. Another great resource that maybe we can link in the show notes is the there's an MECFS crash survival guide put out by the Bateman Horn Center. I love their work. One of the things this guide does that a lot of our patients have found really helpful, there's this section where it sort of like points out all the ways you spend energy that you're not aware of. And they give an example of like, you're on a phone call and it's like, well, holding the phone, listening, thinking of your answer, like all these things that you don't think that's spending energy. That's just like a normal thing you do. Yeah. Well, it costs energy and it has to be paced. Yeah. And they have ideas for rest. And I think one of the other things with this Autism Level Up resource is that what we've put together is a tool that folks can like keep track of what are the, you know, bisensory system, what are the things that are actually restorative. So, you know, in the same way that, you know, if you are feeling like you need more energy, you're feeling listless or restless or whatever you're trying to do to regulate your nervous system, you may not be able to do the things that you used to do before to regulate your nervous system, whether that be, you know, exercise or, you know, I'm going to do some jumping jacks, I'm going to do some push-ups, you can't do that. My mast cells, my autonomic nervous system won't tolerate that. But like, what are you going to do? And so this toolbox is about like, how do you regulate your nervous system in the setting of PEM?
Oh, that sounds like a great resource. I love refer to all the time their regulator 2.0, which is kind
of
like,
that's one of my favorite of their tools. Yeah.
Yeah. How to use sensory input to either up, like kind of energize and upregulate or downregulate. So to be able to do that, but in the context of PEM, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here is how do you find that sweet spot of a lot of us, especially if we're both autistic and ADHD, we need stimulus to feel okay. So like how to find that sweet spot or what I often call like the Goldilocks for the sensory spot when you're in PEM, because yeah, that gets a lot more complex to find that both stimulation so that the ADHD boredom is not just crawling out of our skin, but not so much stimulus that it's contributing to PEM getting worse.
Yes, because I think if you're going to summarize anything, like if you're going to take one thing away, learn what your PEM looks like and stay out of PEM. If you stay out of PEM, you will get better. It's just that if you're not aware that you're in PEM and you don't understand what are the factors that got you there and keep you there, that's going to make it really hard to recover.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I learned this from folks who are in your community, who are also in my community. But this idea of that there's different kinds of PEM, like there's cognitive PEM, there's physical PEM, or I don't know if it's different. I don't know if you'd say it's different kind of PEM or just different triggers. Different triggers. So how people can, but is it a different experience if you're in, like if it's, you go and do exercise and then you have PEM versus like you're doing cognitive complex tasks and you have PEM, is that a different experience of PEM?
I think it's so individualized. Like some people will describe, well, PEM is PEM. This is what my PEM feels like. Some people will say, well, I get a headache if I, or muscle pain, or like some, I get this when I do physical things, but I get brain fog if I do something. But some other people will say, my PEM is PEM. Like, and sometimes it's a mix and match. Like my personal experience is if I have PEM from a physical trigger, I will be more likely to present with like muscle pain and soreness and sore throat and swollen lymph nodes. That'll be how that is. Whereas I'm more likely to have brain fog from, I mean, I'm a brain fog all the time from either of them, and I have light sensitivity from either of them, but the like, and it might just be also severity. Maybe what I think is, well, I get this manifestation from the physical trigger might just be, this is what my more severe PEM looks like, and I get more severe PEM from a physical trigger. So I think it might be like some of that and maybe a mixture of both.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, but I think it's important because I think, you know, to your point about a lot of us, we have these coping mechanisms. We work because we like our identity is tied to our work and our creation, and we get dopamine from it, and it's like our sense of value and worth and like all that stuff. And if you can't physically do the things you did, you're going to probably try to cognitively do the things you're doing. You're going to like, and so you're having to figure out how do I really take a look at, and this is so much privilege of having a community that is unlearning together, but this idea of having value just by being a person, like I have value just by being. It's not about what I create and what I produce and how much work I do and all that stuff. But that shift in self-narrative, I think, is very hard to do alone. I think it's best done together with other people.
That's so well said. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we can do that alone. I think we do that in community. Yeah.
Seems like the natural space to transition out of this time-wise, but I just want to say how much I appreciate you, because I'm already thinking about how many people I'm going to send this episode to when it airs, because of how often we do not talk about the biological side of everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And how much knowledge you just gave us in 45, 50 minutes is, I just always leave our conversations feeling a little more hopeful and inspired about some small changes that I can make in my life to make my life a bit easier. So I want to thank you for that.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Can I like wrap up, like, because I think that we started the conversation looking at like burnout versus PEM, but maybe just to wrap it all up to say that maybe we can't separate them when you have complex chronic illness. Not everyone in autistic burnout has PEM, and we spent a lot of time on PEM and most of the time on PEM, but not everyone with autistic burnout has PEM. But when you have both, autistic burnout and PEM may not be able to be separated. They're the same story told through your brain and your body. And it's just about, like we said before, if we want to recover, we have to honor those energy access needs and care for all the things at once, because everything's connected to everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great wrap.
Thank you. I'm glad you came full circle on that. That's, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time and your time, but also your energy expenditure.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, you gave me energy. So my mitochondria are grateful for you.
Thank you. Do you want to like shout any of your stuff out, or you do want us just link it in the show notes? What's best for you in terms of where to find your resources and all the things?
Yeah, so you could go to allbrainsbelong.org to check out a lot of the things that we talked about today, and then we can link specific resources, including the Everything's Connected to Everything guide, including Brain Club, which is a free community education program that is every Tuesday, but also is recorded if people can't make it live, but where we cover these topics and also just everyday brain life topics of being a neurodivergent person in a normative world. We'd love for folks to join us.
Yeah. I think I just saw an email this morning about a new resource you all have, and you're a nonprofit, so you provide so many free resources for our community, which I just so appreciative of. I hope the grants keep coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
And just thank you for the work. Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me that we had a new project that launched this morning that I forgot about.
You're welcome.
So it's the Brain Club Digital Resource Library. All I said, Brain Club gets recorded. All the archives are available on the website. But if you don't know what day the thing you want was, it's very hard to find the thing because that 3.5 years worth of episodes. So you can now search by topic. So the healthcare topic launched today. In a couple of weeks, it'll be all the topics, employment, regulation, relationships. And we're really excited about that.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. Seriously, thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you for everything you're doing. Making so many people, I would say, and this is certainly my experience when I listen to your podcast, feeling less alone, that there are so many people who experience the things that you experience.
That's our hope. Every time we talk to each other on here and we're like, why are people listening to that is our hope.
Things that people don't talk about. And people, like, if you think you're the only one who has this like mysterious thing and you like, you feel so defective and so broken. And as soon as you hear someone say something that reflects, like, kind of all the time, when one of you will say something, and I'll be like, I've never heard another human say that. Even in a community where we're talking about this stuff all the day, it's like some other way of expressing an inner world experience that you're like, that is my life, and you just gave me words for it.
Mm. Well, you appreciate that for sure, as much as we both hate being perceived.
Full circle, having words for our experiences, especially ones that are disorienting, that helps calm the mitochondria because we're sending signals of like, this makes sense versus signals of threat. Okay. So having language, and that's again, back to community, I think neurodivergent community, we forge language of experiences that many of us are very confused by, and it helps signal safety.
Yeah. And that's how we ship culture.
100%. Yeah, I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad this worked out the way that it did. So I hope everyone who's listening got a lot out of this episode like we did. I hope you enjoyed the Burnout City series, which honestly was probably one of our favorites that we've done together so far. We still want your illustrations, drawings, pictures, photos, whatever you create of Burnout City versus Monotropic Manor. Send them to our email or our Instagram. New episodes are out on Fridays on all major platforms and YouTube. You can like, download, subscribe, and share, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Dr. Neff here. This season, we are clearly talking about autistic burnout, a topic that Neurodivergent Insights has covered extensively. So if you would like more resources to supplement your learning, we've put together a page where we've curated all of our autistic burnout resources, freed and paid resources. We have lots of articles on autistic burnout. We have an upcoming free email course that's going to be released soon. We have workbooks on autistic burnout. So if you'd like to check out our resources, again, both free and paid, you can go to neurodivergentinsights.com /burnout-resources. It's linked below and in the show notes. I hope you don't need these resources, but if you do, they are there for you.